Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies, and we are in the presence of a man who has a presence, Jai Courtney.
Thanks for having me.
He's the Aussie bloke who has been doing...
He's stolen our hearts.
He has. He has.
And cinemas around the world.
He's stolen a lot of screen time.
Stolen screen time.
Well,
that's
no, no.
Good.
No. He's he has held his own opposite the likes of Tom Cruise and Bruce Willis and a lot of heavy hitters.
Yeah.
In films like Jack Reacher, A Good Day to Die Hard, and Divergent, where he's the lead, and Unbroken, where he was part of a great ensemble directed by Angelina Jolie.
Indeed.
And Terminator Genesis, Suicide Squad with Will Smith. And you're a busy fella.
Been doing a bit. I guess any of that's better than stealing cigarettes, which is what I was doing at 13. You know.
Well, so, the statute of limitations.
Screen times, passed, you know, make my mother much more proud. That's for sure.
I'll bet. What do your parents make of this explosive career that you've had?
They're super supportive. You know, no one in my family is in the film business, and so in this world at all so it was a bit of an experiment kind of going into it, but they were always really supportive of my ambitions to want to be an actor. It wasn't something that came at a super young age as far as wanting to do it professionally, and I certainly wasn't kind of pushed into it or kind of coaxed into believing that it was something I loved. It kind of came through an interest in theater, and then I trained, and I don't know, look, they've always been really wonderful and supportive around the realities of how tough it can be, particularly early on, and it is for everyone starting off. And I know, you know, some parents, friends of my friends have, you know, had a tough time kind of getting okay with that. I know, you know, when we were younger, I went to drama school, and you know, some people struggle with the idea that you're going to be unemployed, which is really the reality. That's kind of what you're signing up for, really.
Sure.
You know, it's like, I want to be an actor. It's like, okay, so, you know, you got to go get your certificate to pour drinks in bars and start getting really good at that instead. But no, they've been great and they love it. And yeah, I think it's a healthy kind of level of investment, I guess.
Yeah. You've also now worked with some Australian icons.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's the best way to make family and friends happy is
get
to be
on
like,
board. Yeah.
You know, so me and Russell Crowe, no big deal.
Yeah, me and Kate Blanchett,
no big deal, guys. It's fine.
It is kind of extra special, I guess, when that became the case, that's for sure. Yeah, they enjoy that a lot.
I think in part, you're so far away. Australia is far away. It's a beautiful place, but it's a journey.
It's a bit of a drive.
To leave, yeah. You know? It's a journey, so I feel like it is sort of this club. And you do stick together. It's very much that, like...
It's an interesting thing. And I think it's, you know, I've always thought it was kind of funny because I think the idea of, you know, Aussie actors in LA, for instance, is... It's a little more of an idea than the reality. But it also isn't at all. And there is a lot of history shared, whether it's things we worked on before we got out here, or it's stuff you go home and do, or it's just even... You know, even just having an interest, like it's obviously from a population standpoint, a much smaller country than the States. And so when you're hearing about your peers that are, you know, things are really kicking off for, or You know, things start to happen for someone who, you know, last week was literally on like your home and aways or, you know, that sort of stuff. And it is, you know, it's kind of, it's one of those things we sort of joke about, but it is true. And it's kind of great because we're each other's cheerleaders as well. Mm-hmm. And
but that's what I mean. You really are.
Yeah.
That's what I think more than anything else. And it is, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
But you always hear that with different Aussie actors. It's like, oh, they really want the other to succeed.
Totally, yeah, of course.
That's why I say it's beautiful, because it's a nice thing. You also, many of you go back and do theater.
Yeah.
Which is incredible too. My dad was just reading, you went back, you did Macbeth.
I did, yeah.
Like,
you didn't just do theater.
Yeah.
You did Macbeth, man.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, figured if we were going to make the trip and do it, you know. might as well have a few things to say.
Not a Neil Simon comedy, but Macbeth.
I know. It was a bit of it was pretty scary. It was a great call to get. I trained classically, so that's kind of actually the world closer to where I cut my teeth, I guess. Mm-hmm. But just through the nature of how things have rolled out for me, I haven't done any. I hadn't been on stage for like 8 years, and then I hadn't done Shakespeare since drama school.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was invited to do that, it was kind of like, it's that kind of phone call you get where you know, you kind of wish you didn't get it because now you've got to deal with the reality of taking it on, but you know you can't say no, you know. And there was so much work ahead, and I was totally daunted by it all, but such a thrilling kind of exercise to go through. And it really reignited that like passion for it and how different that kind of working in that space is. It's such a different energy going on stage every night. And I want to do more of it. That's for sure. Mm-hmm.
So was it different for you every night?
The play? Yeah. Oh yeah, totally.
How long did you do it?
It's not it wasn't a crazy long run. I think we were up like 7 weeks, which, you know, in Broadway terms is nothing at all.
Right.
You barely get through your previews. But that's pretty standard in Oz. Probably the attention span of Aussie audiences is like, we're over it by then. So, you know, put something else up. It's different every night. I mean, and just because of the energy in the room can change. And and just how an audience decide they want to kind of, where they want to get on board with certain stuff. It's always interesting because sometimes a play like that can be, like the laughs really land, and then other nights people just, that's the last thing they want to do. It was kind of wild. It's always interesting with other actors too, because sometimes your sense of what's working or not is completely different with each other.
Mm.
You know, the woman playing playing Lady Macbeth, Geraldine Hakewell, amazing young Aussie actress. We would like pass each other in the corridor sometimes at the back, and I'd be like, it's going great. She'd be like, no, I'm making a fucking terrible show. And you're like, what do you mean? They love it. And it's like, no, I fucked my whole thing up. And sometimes it can get so kind of, because you can get in your own world and you can hang on to it. That's the funny thing about, you know, theater, there's no kind of second take.
Sure.
And so it'd be like, you know, sometimes even just like the delivery on something would just like not kind of work for your own self-edit that's going on in your mind. And that can like, it's hard to let go of that sometimes. I mean, sometimes you're still trapped in that thing for the next 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. One night I ran on stage and and before I said my first line, I had already tripped over. And this is true. I had to like jump up on the back of like a burning car. It's kind of the set we had on this huge Revolve. I like come out, boop, boop, jumping up. And I slip on the bumper and like smack my head.
Oh, God.
Like landed on my weapon. It was like the worst, most like clumsy entrance to anything. And there's no like, all right, guys, that was stupid. Let me take that again.
Right.
You just got to get up and you're like, fucking, how do you recover from that? Like, I'm Macbeth and I got to like,
I got to
get
do.
These
you
dudes
go,
on.
Macbeth.
I got to get this whole gang on board now after that entrance.
Oh, man.
But
did you use your own accent?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's perhaps not as broad as my accent might get from an Australian standpoint, but we didn't use an accent for the play, no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you just soldiered on after that moment.
I had to soldier on.
Yeah,
that's it. It's like, what do you do? The show must go on, and you just it's that thing of going, man, I just want this one to end so I can re-enter on the next one.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And not feel like...
It freaked me out a little bit. I mean, I must say, because...
Well, how could it not?
Yeah. And then you kind of go and... I remember, like, maybe that was the matinee and we had a show that night. And we had sort of a stunt coordinator guy there who was running, like, the rigging. And there was a few, you know, we had a lot of stuff in the... that had to fly in and out. And he, like, pulled me aside for, like, 20 minutes. And he knew. I didn't have to kind of put my hand up, but he knew that somewhere that would sit within me on a level of, like, if you're going to think about that every time you run out and jump on the back of that car, like, chances are you'll create that reality for yourself again and it'll happen. Because it was, there was nothing I could be more, like, sure-footed about. It was literally just like you're stepping up on something. Like, you could trip on a stair. And he really, like, had this exercise of making me, like, look at that back of the bumper of the car and be like, fuck you. Fuck you, I'm going to get you. And it worked. I mean, it never happened again, but I had to, like, build that into my warm-up every
night. How very smart of him to realize that and to reach out to you.
Totally.
And try to, you know, get that out of your head.
Totally. He was like, before that becomes like poison in your mind, you know, let's go and shake it and turn it into something else. So certainly appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and it was a modern day rendering.
It was,
right?
Simon Phillips directed it. It was, and he kind of has a, I guess that's kind of what he does wonderfully. Mm-hmm. Not always like with a modern adaptation or like world, but I think that's an interesting thing with Shakespeare is kind of, that's often the thing that raises questions because people, you know, want to know why or where, or if you're going to like plug it into another time and space, well then. But that was kind of happening when he was writing those plays as well. And I think, I don't know, that's just one of those things that I think it's real. I think it's just, why not? You know, it's just really comes down to a design perspective and like how you're going to, like how the world looks. It doesn't mean that you're drawing parallels between the dictators of today or let's wear in, you know, it's now the breakup of Yugoslavia. And it's like sometimes I think that shit people want to get bogged down in in where it all, what it all means. And I think it can sometimes be fun to just let go of it and say, hey man, what's the palette and how can our costumes be amazing and let's create something that it's aesthetically enjoyable and exciting. And so but we had, you know, we had like rifles as opposed to swords is the closest
and obviously you had cars
burning ones
burning cars.
You had just, burning just cars the
one
to jump on.
Just the one and it was burning
Well, I wish I could have seen it. That's quite something.
Now, well,
did you do Home and Away or Neighbors?
I didn't do Home and Away or Neighbors. I did do some like guest stuff on Aussie TV you know, early on before I kind of, before anything else was going on. And it's always like a great kind of breeding ground.
I mean, are you the only Australian actor who hasn't been on Neighbours and Home and Away?
No, there's a few more, I'm sure.
There's like two of you?
It's funny. It used to be, I think it's just because of the way things evolved. It was like such the jump.
Sure.
And it was, you know, our business, film and TV is, you know, it's very different. We don't produce as much content, I'm sure, as you can imagine. Nowhere near is what's going on over here. And I think, you know, those shows, there's a high like turnover rate. I think that's the thing. And young actors, it's really possible to get a job on one of those shows.
Yes, of course.
And so it becomes like a great place for getting a start, honing your skills and, and like finding who the hell you are as an actor.
Yeah.
But that's, it's the exact same thing as obviously in the UK, they have those sorts of shows here, Law and Order, ER when it was on for all those years. But that's why
daytime soap operas.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's that's why I tease you about it because everyone did it because that's what you did. Yeah.
It's like where you can get work, you know? Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, the amazing thing these days with how kind of international and how, you know, those borders have really been opened up globally in the world of cinema and TV, you know, everyone's getting jobs now off tape. Yeah. Even if you're here, I mean, it's so different now. Getting in the room, that whole idea is like shifted in a major way. And
right. And by getting in the room, just to translate the lingo for those who are not show business savvy, it means getting to meet either the director or the casting director.
Well, it quite literally means going in and auditioning in a room in front of humans.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you have FaceTime.
Right, right.
And they can get a sense of you and you get a sense of them. And that used to be the only way it was done.
Totally. Totally the only way. And I think now, you know, whether it's, you know, who it caters to, I think is kind of, it can be a positive thing and kind of a negative thing. I think that FaceTime that you used to get a little more often was sometimes really valuable. But, you know, the reality is sometimes now, I mean, particularly when you've got casting happening out of Australia, in the UK, you know, the States, and then you've got kids all around the world who, you know, want to throw their hat in the ring and can't get to wherever they are, or maybe they're working on something else in New Zealand. And and so, you know, casting offices wind up with these kind of pools of thousands of tapes because they want to see everyone. And it's so often how discoveries are made. So it's kind of crazy, but it has changed a lot. Which, you know, I think it makes it a lot more possible because...
Sure.
You know, back
anybody can theoretically get in the door.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is awesome.
Yeah. Now, so how did you get cast in Spartacus? Because this miniseries of Spartacus was your real breakthrough, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I just auditioned out of the old fashioned way in Sydney. And I remember that was really cool at the time. I'd only been out of drama school maybe a year or so. And, you know, I'm like a bigger guy, and I was, you know, I was often up against, still am really in a way, like some of the stuff that like felt a little more, I don't know, versatile. It was kind of like, you know, I don't know, being like a big dude was not necessarily a helpful thing because. Well,
to clarify, you're human sized.
Yeah.
And many actors are quite petite.
That's true.
They tend to be on the shorter side, but not just that. They're very small.
Small.
Not all.
Not all.
But quite a few.
Yeah.
Teeny tiny people. So the fact that you look like a person could have an effect.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what they were looking for on Spartacus was person-sized people.
Yes.
And
my friends will tell you that is literally how I describe it. When we get to meet somebody, they go, well, I go, he was people-sized.
He was people-sized.
Good news. Good news.
That's good. I'm going to take that one.
Oh, yeah. My husband.
Tell that to my agents next
time. That's right. My husband.
If it's helpful to you, go right ahead.
My husband describes Sylvester Stallone as being disappointingly small.
Oh, really?
That was it. So whereas you, my friend, you're people-sized.
People-sized.
You're people-sized.
Well, yeah. So, you know, I was stoked to be able to go in for something that we're looking for people-sized people being people-sized.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because, you know, that job offered me so much. It totally broke open my idea of what was possible. What was like even it was kind of coming at a time. I mean, HBO were already killing it with some bigger stuff. But this is like pre-Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peter Jackson had done all this amazing stuff through his studio in NZ. And I think Avatar, the first one, had just been shot. But really these like huge kind of, I mean, you know, whatever. We've been making them forever. But it was great to see something that had a lot of kind of, you know, that really wanted to pump effects and like costume and build worlds into like TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that was something that had, you know, been done a lot then. And my mind was totally blown going over there. We shot that in Auckland in New Zealand and you know, building these arenas. It was like,
yeah.
And kind of I mean, yeah, other than that, I mean, it really just offered me a start and
sure.
And quite practically speaking, like gave me a reason to be able to get on a plane and come to the States and you know, try and have a crack.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't come here with a job. You came here to sort of make your way?
Yeah, I came here after Spartacus. You know, my friend Andy Whitfield, who was the lead in that show on the first season, and he passed away, as I'm sure you know, a couple years after that. But he had offered me a lot of – he was kind of the only person I knew who had done that. I was like, what's the LA thing all about? Because I was super green at the time. And, just kind of like let me in on how the hell the function of all that is. And it's so funny because it becomes such an obvious – thing to you a couple of years later when you've been doing that kind of that grind and Aussies who come to the States and, you know, are familiar with that system of doing pilot season, you know, at the start of the year or whatever. I mean, get really used to, it's like a, you know, it's a sad kind of culture of rejection.
Yep.
You're broke. You're coming back and forth. It's about like getting enough money together when you get home to be able to get a plane ticket again.
Mm-hmm.
Where the hell do you stay? You're crashing on couches or you know, I was at the Banana Bungalow up here on Fairfax when I first got here. It was so great and so bad at the same time. But, you know, it's a really special part of the journey in the process. And I think it's really necessary. I mean, I don't look, I think it's, if you can roll out of bed and decide you want to be an actor and you get a major motion picture and all of a sudden everything happens overnight for real, then, you know, more power to you. But, I think there's something to be said for getting on that kind of, you know, having a bit of that struggle, that's for sure. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm realistic about the fact that, you know, I was lucky enough to start getting work after probably what doesn't feel like a particularly long amount of time. I was more than ready, believe me, when my first film offer came through, you know, because it always feels like longer than you think, you know, you want it to be. But there's something said to be that, for that, and yeah, I think it's kind of valuable.
In terms of sequence, because did you shoot the film with Joel Edgerton, Felony, first, or did you do Jack Reacher first?
I did Jack Reacher, and then actually Felony came like a year after that. I did Jack Reacher, and then went home and did a film called I, Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
and then did Good Day to Die Hard.
Yeah.
And then Felony was after that one.
So within a year,
yeah,
you're co-starring with Tom Cruise and with Bruce Willis mm-hmm. in major Hollywood motion pictures.
That was bizarre.
Just two of the most famous action stars.
So crazy. It was very cool. Very, very cool. And I look, it is kind of funny, and it's you know, it's no secret I've been part of a couple of, like, you know, the couple of big like 80s franchises mm-hmm. that kind of came on and like rolling in. And I really do feel incredibly lucky to have been able to mix it up with some of these guys, because they were heroes of mine, you know, watching movies growing up.
Of course they were.
Like, you know, of so many of us. And I mean, like Tom, for instance, is like the ultimate, you know, when it comes to like movie star, professional, mm-hmm. like, you know, filmmaker. He really drives those things, and for that to be kind of like the first thing, the first big, you know, kind of commercial thing I was working on was just awesome. It was like seeing him in action is like this, it's so inspiring.
Talk about little people. He's a little bit. But I was amazed for the fact that he's not very tall, not very big. Charisma like I've never experienced.
Tons, yeah.
Like, truly, I will say, of everyone that I've been in a room with, and I've been lucky because my dad does what he does.
Yeah.
When that man walked into the room, everyone knew.
Yeah.
And not because he was being any sort of over the top or wasn't hitting you over the head. He just came in and everybody went,
oh, wow.
You just
said it. He doesn't need to.
No,
he
doesn't.
Exactly right. He just commands the space.
Exactly right. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you about doing the film with Joel Edgerton.
We love Joel Edgerton.
Because he's great.
We love him so much.
I love Joel Edgerton.
He wrote the script.
Yeah.
But didn't direct it.
That's right.
And also starred in it. So you're reading his line.
Yeah.
To him.
To him. And in front of him.
Mm.
And like, does he ever say,
you're doing it wrong.
You're doing it wrong. No, that's not what I really meant by that.
No, I know what you mean. I was pretty nervous. I remember thinking at the time, because, you know, most of our stuff in that movie isn't actually together, just because of where our characters are kind of placed. Mm-hmm. But I remember the first day that I was there doing some of my stuff and Joel showed up and I was like, oh shit, I gotta like, he's going to be like policing this from behind the monitors, like watching this, thinking like, it's not the way I'd do it. But that's not Joel at all, you know? I mean, look, man, he wrote a great script. So there wasn't really, you know, and I'm he was involved in the casting process and stuff. So I think it's just when you think like that, it's about just shaking it off and kind of realizing that you're meant to be there and you can just trust in your own instincts and choices and trust in what you've, you know, the character that you've found. So it's kind of great. I think if anything, that ends up becoming something you can utilize more than something that is an obstacle. And it's not always the case. I've never worked with a writer director who's been incredibly like super prescriptive, which, and I know there's, you know, some are and I look forward to that challenge one day. But I'm sure that'd be kind of, I mean, look, this is another exercise. Like Shakespeare, you can't mess with that, right?
Yeah.
Shakespeare and Mamet.
You don't mess.
These are the two things you cannot.
You don't mess with it. So it's kind of like, whilst it might make things hard I don't know. I'm not someone who is like an incredibly, I don't like improvise necessarily a ton. It's just not my style. I don't mind getting things to fit a little better in my mouth, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just the way,
how you
the
say
sense
it,
of things.
Yeah.
And that I think is usually a little up for grabs, I think, in, I would say, in most cases. I mean, most people want their film to feel natural and for the script to feel like it's, you know, authentic. And so that can just be part of it. But yeah, I mean, I know, you know, there's a lot of people out there as well that feel like these are my words and these are my characters. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's your job to like honor that. And I don't not believe in that at all. I think that's valid too. But certainly Joel wasn't, you know.
He wasn't that guy.
Wasn't crazy, but yeah, it was all good.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Who knows what he's like as a director, though?
Oh, right.
He's probably a jackass, you know.
Oh, yeah. He says that we got to have him on, and the two of us truly fangirled.
Right.
Like, we really just, like, gazed lovingly in his direction, going, "Oh, Joel Edgerton, we think you're great.
Yeah.
You're the niftiest."
He has that effect, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, you've done so much high-powered action stuff, and I wonder, obviously you went to drama school and you must have had sword play. And
it was a bit of sword play.
Personal
for
stage
sure.
work.
A lot of sword play at drama school.
Mm-hmm. But not leaping through plate glass windows or
he's an innocent.
Anything
okay.
of, you know, anything of that sort.
Yeah.
What kind of things have you... What have been some of the challenges you've had to deal with in terms of green screen work where you're imagining everything around you that isn't
there?
Well,
I'll say that. I mean, it's funny you mention that because I find that to be some of the hardest stuff I've ever had to tackle when it comes down to...
Tennis ball's not a good castmate there? No?
I mean, listen, we've all done some opposite stuff to a tennis ball and a C-stand as well. I mean, sometimes they are easier to work with than other cars. There's a time and place for them too. but I think the faking the stakes of something can be really tricky. And sometimes it's as simple as just that old idea of like having to look like an idiot. You know, that thing.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And we talk about, you know, you talk about that when you're like starting to become an actor, about the freedom of having to just kind of go, look, stop. You can't judge yourself. Mm-hmm. Like you got to be unafraid to look stupid. And that will open up your mind and open up the possibility of what it is you're going to discover. But yeah, I've done a few things where you're on you're just on a soundstage at a studio with big green curtains everywhere and X's painted all over them. And it's all about like, there's your eye line and then this thing's coming to kill you. And to endow that with some sense of urgency and like real like threat, that's just when the acting comes into play, I guess, sometimes. And it's a funny old thing because, you know, this business, this world, this art form, I feel like sometimes what we're really trying to do is just stray away from it being that at all. And you're trying to create realities that just feel like you're in that world. And some actors respond to that idea differently. I really enjoy it when a set feels like you're just in a place and the relationships,
of course.
You know.
Well, it's got to make your job at least 50% easier.
100%.
Yeah, you don't have to pretend you're standing by a waterfall. You're standing by
waterfall. Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's, you know, when sometimes the big action things like that or if it gets a little fantastical, that's when a bit of that work can come in. And
Well, Suicide
it's just different,
Squad.
Man. Yeah. Squad.
And I saw your Squad tattoo.
Yeah, it's there.
You
still.
Are legit. I like it's there still. That's how tattoos work.
Yeah.
It is still attached.
Some of them. I had one once that is completely gone.
Is it really?
Yeah, it was a stick and poke that my buddy gave me with like pen ink and a sewing needle.
Oh, God.
And,
that a boy.
It just,
you're a braver just, man than I am, Gunga Din.
It's gone. Thankfully, probably for the best.
I've got a magic wand on my middle finger that I think maybe it gets used too often or something.
It's got a little light.
It's fading away. But that movie.
Yeah.
Holy moly. Actors alone, obviously. Wow. What a group.
Yeah. Was a great
group.
And,
you know, and there's another one. Will Smith, another person who walks in and you just go, hello, light.
Yeah, totally.
Like, he's really...
100%. He's a He's luminescent. For sure.
He's the cheerleader I'd want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to
anything push for anything me on, in life.
You know, egg me on for something. Can't.
Bring me Will.
But that's it. Like, can you imagine if we could bottle little bitty Will Smith? I just realized I'm saying that. Go. The genie.
I think they did.
If we could just genie little Will Smiths everywhere. But you know, because he's that kind of a guy. But that whole cast, the movie itself, of course, is bonkers.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
And your character, the way you look, it's wild and I love it. And I can't imagine walking into that situation.
I know. It's pretty crazy. It was a big kind of big deal. We're getting ready to do it again. It's literally, we're about to go and do the second one.
Oh, my God.
Which will be a lot of fun. And it's been a minute because, you know, it's been a few years now, which is kind of bizarre. We didn't know if it was happening or not. And so it's kind of nice.
Suicide again.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
That's suicide the, also.
That's the title. Suicide also.
Captain Boomerang lives.
Suicide 2, Electric Boogaloo, Whoopsie Daisy. Yeah.
That's going to be it.
I'm excited. I'm very excited about all the crazy that's going to.
Let me ask you about stunt work, which also plays a big role in some of these high powered movies you've done.
And because you're people sized, especially.
Yeah. I mean,
harder to crush.
How does this lay out? Do you have any say in what you're willing to do, how far you're willing to go in terms of
physically, sure.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of control over that. Sometimes not as much in the sense of what you would like to be allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's changing a little, you know, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just the nature of the different things, you know, you work on at time, but some of those early ones, for instance, like Jack Reacher, you know, that car chase we have, and there's a car chase in the movie and where my character is going after Tom's, and at a particular point I find him on the roads, and we have this kind of, we're crashing into each other across mm-hmm. this bridge. And of course, you know, they did that in different kind of shots and angles with the stunt team. Mm-hmm. And then it was time to bring Tom and I in, and I mean, they let us do that. You know, that's really me and Tom Cruise smashing into each other in cars, going like, you know, 60 miles an hour across a bridge in Pittsburgh, which was totally insane to me at the time. I was like, I mean, I remember right before we went on this one thing, and I'm kind of like, the heart's pumping, you know, adrenaline's like surging through my veins, and there's a lot of preparation, as you can imagine, to getting this kind of thing right, obviously, but you know, everyone's at their ones. We're getting ready to go. It's everyone good. Stunt coordinators in. Everyone checking in on you, checking on him. All right, we're good. Sweet, gonna get that. Everyone's on the walkie. And right before we go, I look across and Tom's like, "You good?" I'm like, "I'm good." And I see him put a mouth guard in.
Oh no!
And I was like, "Wait, wait, I didn't get a mouth guard." I didn't get the mouth guard. I was like. Anyway, but it was awesome because, you know, you just kind of got to go for it at a certain point. And all the measures are in place to, you know, promote safety and obviously, and that's always the case. And listen, things happen, we know. But I've never worked with any like real cowboys in this business that are kind of interested in putting actors in harm's way. And I hope never to. I mean, it's no excuse for it, really. We are all trying to avoid getting hurt, and even like having your doubles. I mean, they're not there to bang up, but I mean, sometimes it's just there's stuff you certainly can't perform, and that's why you know you're surrounded by
talented, tough
individuals like that.
Are there instances where you want to or you wish you could?
Yeah, there's definitely that, and it can just come down to
insurance.
Yeah,
insurance.
Yeah, totally, and that's true. I mean, it's like things happen. I mean, someone like Tom, though. I mean, I think Tom probably dictates what Tom gets to do, and that's why he's...
With a mouth guard.
Why he's hanging off airplanes.
If you're going to lose your teeth some way, being able to say that you lost them because of Tom Cruise in an epic battle scene...
Totally. That's not a bad way to do
it. That's worth it, you know? Mm-hmm. Better than like, I slipped on a bumper even.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I lost some teeth because I slipped on a bumper. No, Tom Cruise.
Tell you what, I could have lost some teeth when I slipped on that bumper of that car.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
I'm going to be thinking about that. That image, that it's like an actor's nightmare image.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
It's a moment when you'd rather be naked.
Oh, God.
Than fall down. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
We've all had some version of the embarrassment, whether it's tripping, falling, somethinging.
Yeah.
And then just going, please don't ever let that be a thing again. Please, please no.
Yeah, indeed.
Terminator Genesis is another one where you stepped into another franchise, mm-hmm. as they call them, where in this case it had already been rebooted, and yep. now it's being re-rebooted.
Yes. Being re-rebooted, yeah.
Arnold is people-sized.
He's people-sized.
He's people. Don't yell at me right now.
Okay. He's people-sized.
He's people-sized enough. The hair makes up for anything else.
You think Arnold's not people-sized?
I think he's pretty people-sized. Yeah.
He's pretty big, dude.
I think I was expecting.
He's very solid.
Yes.
He's still jacked.
I think yeah. I was expecting Shaquille O'Neal.
Right.
And so when he was just like a tall fella with muscles,
Yeah.
What do you mean you're not a robot? Wait a second. Governator, what's going on?
Right.
He is one of the savviest, use that word again, one of the savviest people I've ever seen in action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've not been on a set with him, but
He has people in the palm of his hand.
He just knows who he
yeah.
is
yeah.
and knows why he's there, whatever it is he's going to do.
Yeah.
And I find that really, not only admirable, but... almost intimidating. It's like, boy, this guy really has a more than a clue.
How many people end political speeches with one of their catchphrases? Not everyone would say,
many.
I'll be back.
I don't think there's many that can.
Like,
yeah.
come on.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
No, he's, he's amazing. And that's like, talk about like being around credible people that kind of to watch how they handle with
sure.
such economy. Mm-hmm. Like that sort of stuff. And you're right. I mean, it's just the those years in the saddle and knowing exactly what audiences want mm-hmm. from him and mm-hmm. how to deliver that is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've ticked off some pretty amazing boxes.
In Divergent, though, you got to be the guy. What appealed to you about that part? And that, played it twice now.
I think it was just what they... I don't know. I hadn't sort of played in that space before. And it was coming at a time when... I mean, the YA young adult
yeah.
novel adaptation thing was really kind of kicking off. And I don't know. It was just like had some great people. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be part of that ensemble. And I saw some fun in that character. It was, it was interesting. The second time round when we did Insurgent, I was shooting Terminator at the time. And so... I had to like go out there. That was the first time that had happened where I was doing two things at the same time.
Oh my.
It actually, I mean, through the miracles of scheduling, they managed to lean it out a lot. And you know, I essentially had to go there and chase some people through the woods and then get killed. But
nailed it.
Yeah, nailed it.
Nailed it.
If only they were all that simple, right? You know what I mean? But I mean, it's great. And you know, so I still have some amazing relationships from that experience.
You've done a lot of ensemble films,
mm-hmm.
which is really cool.
Like Unbroken.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And it's often the case, and maybe this has just been through the good fortune of casting and kind of who has been assembled, but I feel like I really I've made lifelong friends off all of those pictures, which is, sounds kind of nice, but that's not always the case.
No.
Not at all.
So often
and
it's like
I think it's yeah, and I just I feel really I genuinely feel very lucky to be able to say that and mean it because you hear about I got friends who worked on things and the whole cast just kind of don't really have time for each other and everyone's there and maybe you're just like your schedules aren't colliding well and kind of coming in and out and you end up kind of doing your bit and leaving. And it feels like you're surrounded by these amazing people, but no one really gets to know each other. And I guess just been lucky in that sense to spend some really amazing time with really talented people and then to be able to like find a genuine love and appreciation for each other and carry that on in the real world.
Yeah.
I think that's great. So often I think an actor's life has got to be leaves you emotionally vulnerable because you have a closeness or an apparent closeness for a very concentrated time.
Yeah.
And then it's like the carnival packs up its tents.
Yeah.
And moves on.
Totally.
And so to have a takeaway, as you've just described, is like a bonus.
Yeah.
icing on the cake.
Yeah, it is. It's cool. And then you get the those crazy times when you work with people again, mm-hmm. you know, you come back. I mean, this happened, you know, we're talking about Semper Fi today, right? That's coming out soon. And like Finn Wittrock, who's in that, was in Unbroken with me. That's when we met 5 years ago or something. And so, and we've been boys ever since. So to then kind of wind up 5 years later talking about maybe boarding the same thing, and going through that process once again with someone who there, you already had that love built between and respect was awesome. And that, you know, I hope that happens many times over with some of the great people I've, you know, been
It's bound to because you've racked up so many credits in such a short amount of time.
And you're young and you've got a lot of years ahead of you with this. So I'm sure.
Hope so.
Yeah. Right. This is the end.
This is it. Yeah.
What's the best location you've been on? You've traveled all over the globe now for your work.
Best location?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I've shot in like kind of bizarre places sometimes, but not really like what you, I don't know, maybe you call it exotic. I don't know. I've never been on like some kind of paradise, like trapped away on some amazing island. That'd be cool. I don't know. I just like being in kind of cities that I wouldn't have necessarily found myself before.
You said you flew in from Bulgaria.
I did. Yeah, I was in Sofia, Bulgaria yesterday. I woke up there, and I'd woken up there a few times in the last couple of weeks, I just finished on a movie called Jolt, which we wrapped up in Bulgaria. You know, we shot Die Hard in Budapest all those years ago, which, I mean, it's funny because these are actually common places, you know, around the world that films often happen. The reality of that is location and also the, you know, how the crews operate there and the system, you know, and the support network, the infrastructure of studios and that sort of thing. But often films are out like Budapest, Prague, Sofia.
They all have a deep crew.
Yeah.
There are a lot of crew people. They're available and they're very experienced.
Yeah.
And they have an infrastructure.
Totally.
Yeah.
Whereas some countries don't.
Yeah.
You shot in Belgium too?
I did shoot in Belgium. That's right. Yeah. See, I'll probably forget half of the places I've enjoyed the most just because of the nature of this. That was fun, actually. We shot this film called The Exception there in Belgium. We were doubling it for the Netherlands, like 1940 occupied Holland, I guess. And we shot almost all of the movie on this one estate, this huge house out in the country outside Brussels, which was amazing because it was total time warp. And like, talk about not having to use your imagination. I really like, and you just, this place had been like wonderfully preserved by this family. And I don't know, that was really special to just kind of, because the difference between building that, I mean, and this is not to say, and you know how amazing like art department stuff can be when worlds are really created from scratch and you totally buy into it because of how kind of masterful that you know, that work can be. But it is kind of cool when you really feel the creak in the floorboards of a place that's been there for 200 years and, you know, it has such history in the walls. It's just kind of... I don't know. You can transport so much more easily.
Yeah, I would think so. I would certainly think so. And that was one where you got to work with Christopher Plummer.
That's right.
And Janet McTeer. I mean, these are heavyweights.
Yeah. That was amazing. Christopher Plummer was like, I don't know. It was just he's a special person.
Yeah.
To have in the room, and watch someone work with such kind of precision was great. Really,
I don't know if you're a reader. Avid reader.
I don't know if you can read.
Sometimes I forget whether I can or not. I'm bad. I'm like embarrassingly not good at like getting through books.
I'm
so
dyslexic. You're fine.
But you're go fine. On.
I was just going to say Christopher Plummer's autobiography is an incredible book.
I should read that.
What a life he has had. Yeah. My gosh. And is still having.
Right. Yeah, of course.
That's some pretty wild stories in that book. And he's pretty tough on himself, too.
Is he really?
Yeah. He owns up to a lot of stuff.
Right on. It's a
very, very absorbing book of a great life and a great life in theater. And theater means so much more to him than film.
Right.
And
wow.
Most people know him from movies, of course. And he continues to make them on a pretty steady basis. But he is truly a man of the theater. Mm. It's a hell of a book.
So this film, Semper Fi,
yeah.
It's another one where you've got a really, really lovely cast around you. And Arturo Castro, mm-hmm. I didn't know who he was, except that he has this new TV show on Comedy Central.
Yep.
I didn't know him otherwise, so I was actually really happy to see him in this because he's really good.
He's really good, yeah.
And I thought, oh, what a lovely sort of appetizer.
Right.
Because now I want to see what else he does.
Right, right.
You know, but also, I mean, it's you say Finn Wittrock and Nat Wolff. It's
Bo Knapp.
Bo Knapp. Yeah. Leighton Meester. Like, it's a really lovely cast. And this movie goes all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really, it's a journey.
And it's pretty wild.
I can't imagine for you guys shooting it.
It was pretty, I mean, look, I think it's so, I mean, it's one of those things where it depended so much on getting that ensemble of guys right and together because.
You play Marine Corps reservists.
Yeah. Yes.
It centers around, you know, five best friends who are all Marine Corps reservists and kind of the events that surround their first deployment you know, how that kind of tests their loyalty to one another and their loyalty to themselves and how they kind of view the world, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so building that relationship, which is really what is the, I think the hero of the movie is the love between these guys.
100%. Yes.
And it doesn't work unless we believe that 100%.
Well, even the affection, I'm always taken with, you know, men can be against the affection thing. Mm-hmm. Not always, because that's very much a generalization. But in the sense of saying I love you to each other, holding each other, hugging each other in a way that goes sort of just beyond just like, hey, man, you know, bro hug.
Yeah.
And so this scene, when you first see Finn Wittrock, it gives nothing away, but just you see Finn Wittrock after he's been injured.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you guys are holding each other, I even think you kiss him on the head, like it's very sweet. And to me, it is a lovely thing to see because it reminds people that this is, you are allowed to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, it doesn't make you less manly because when you see a friend, you say, I love you and you appreciate them and you can hold each other when you need it.
100%. I think that's an interesting kind of theme that it explores a little because it's a lot about the vulnerability of these men. And these are guys who are, you know, not only, do they serve in the Marine Corps, in the reserves, but, you know, public servants. You know, Cal, my character, is a police officer. Bo's character is a firefighter. I mean, these guys are construction workers. These are tough working class, small town Americans. But at no point, I think, does that suggest that the love and the tenderness between them and the history they've shared can be explored in a way that's, you know, that does kind of expose their vulnerability because it really forces them to question that. And it's just interesting because Henry Alex Rubin, who directed the film, you know, this is really a love letter, I think, from him to people that work in the armed forces. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you see those relationships and the brotherhood and sisterhood between those people, it's kind of it's like an untouchable loyalty that, when you get to know people in those communities, you just have an enormous amount of respect for. And I know he's always been kind of in awe of that. And so we wanted to create something where we could authentically portray that on screen. And obviously the events in the story really kind of test the love between these guys. But if that wasn't something that was explored properly I don't know. It wouldn't have felt right. And they're certainly the people that I know that are, you know, I mean, so many of them are such big hearted lovers and such passionate people because they're in touch with, I don't know what it really means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, that was something that was really interesting and important to us.
Well, but I really think that you succeeded. I really, really do in that way that it was a beautiful relationship to see and experience and definitely that's what I took away from the movie.
Awesome.
Is that part. As I say, I love that scene specifically. It really drove home just the way that you guys could hold each other. I know I keep saying that, but sure. But it is that. It's the, I love you, and we don't have to make any jokes about it. You know what I mean? We don't have to like hug each other and be like, oh, get off me. No. You can just be there with each other.
Yeah, because that's bullshit.
Okay.
And I mean, that's the thing. And I think if that was the path that it explored, it wouldn't have been, it would have done a disservice to these men and women and to what it is they really share. And that wouldn't have been fair. Mm-hmm. So thank you. I'm glad that resonated.
Very much so.
Yeah. Listen, we're almost out of time, but I got to ask you.
You have a full day.
You not only did you work with Russell Crowe, you were directed by Russell Crowe.
I was.
In The Water Diviner.
Yeah.
And what's he like as a director?
Russell's great as a director. That was, a really special experience. Russell's been a hero of mine in this world, in the filmmaking kind of, as an actor, I guess is what I'm trying to say, forever. So to get a chance to work not only alongside him, but kind of under him as a performer was really, really special. And it was amazing. It was amazing to see him and the journey he was going on with his character and leading us in that sense, but also leading us from kind of having the helm of the ship and guiding all that action and all that, all those relationships within it. And also, I don't know, man, I think he's born for that kind of, he's one of those guys. He's such a like loving, hospitable, kind of warm, welcoming dude that likes to bring people around, likes to bring people around the fire, around the table. Mm-hmm. He really does. And I think, so it was kind of great to see him really, really owning that from every kind of angle and assembling that group of people and kind of pulling that whole thing together. So yeah, I had a really special time with him. I hope to see him do more. I think, it was a great, first directorial effort and I hope he's, I'm sure he has, stories in his kind of, in his bag that he wants to unpack.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I hope he gets to do more of that. Yeah. And I didn't get to see Storm Boy, which is a very solidly Aussie story. It was made as a film 30-some years ago.
Yeah.
Just remade with you. And not only do you get to work with Jeffrey Rush, another Aussie icon.
Again, ticking your boxes.
Yeah. But David Goldpilil.
Yeah.
Oh, who is just a face that you once you see, you never forget.
Yeah,
A presence all his own.
No, David is an incredible human. And that was very special. He, he's in the original and he has a small role in this, but it was amazing to be able to welcome him back and kind of do that. And that film, that story is a really iconic Australian story. It's out there now if people want to check it out. It was wonderful to play a father and play that role. That was a film that I remember so well as a kid because we just kind of watched it all the time. It was one of those kind of ones. I used to just say it was like the film the teacher would put on the last day of term. Because it's on the curriculum still in primary schools, in elementary schools in New South Wales. So it's still a piece of literature that kids are learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to just be able to like dig back into that and for nostalgic purposes was really special.
And it's something for us Americans to discover.
Definitely.
Indeed.
So but we have a lot to look forward to with you. You've got the Cate Blanchett series.
Yep, Stateless. It's coming out next year. It's going to be amazing. Really tackles the refugee crisis, I guess.
Wow.
Kind of at anywhere in the world. It's set around some events that happened in Australia around 2005. But, really, it's an ongoing kind of debate and looks at a lot of different perspectives. It's a really challenging piece of material, which would be great.
And Semper Fi comes out on October 4th.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you just said you wrapped Jolt.
Wrapped Jolt. That'll be coming out next year. About to go do the next squad. So there's a bit going on.
There's a bit going on.
It's exciting.
Which is why we're so pleased you had time for us today.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me in. You've had some amazing people come on the show, so I feel very privileged.
Well,
oh, it's our pleasure.
Privilege is ours.
Really is.
Thank you very much.
Do you have social media? Do you do any of that crazy?
I'm on Instagram. Okay. That's it. Yeah. I I could be better, but I haven't got on in the Twitterverse just yet. But
well, you're busy with
other you're so busy being an actor.
Just too busy to tweet.
Just waking up in Bulgaria one morning and being in LA the next morning. Yeah.
No. But anyway.
Well, good on you.
Thank you.
That's right. Good on you.
Yeah, cheers. Appreciate it.
And Jesse, where do people find us?
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
Which I enjoy doing very much.
That's right. And we are now on Patreon. We call it our Maltreon. And that's patreon.com/Maltin on movies.
If you want to help support what we do. And we appreciate all the support you've given us. And with that, we'll say goodbye till next week. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.